Today's Teisho will be on case 56 in the Heikigan Roku, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 56 is Kinzan and one arrow piercing the three barriers. Engo's introduction. No one has ever come into the world. No law has ever been handed down. Bodhidharma did not come to China. No transmission from mind to mind took place. People of today do not understand the truth, but seek it out in the external world. They do not know that even the thousand holy ones cannot discover the great cause that lies at each person's feet. Now, at this moment, how does it happen that while seeing, you do not see, while hearing, you do not hear, speaking, you do not speak, and knowing, you do not know? If you have not understood this, study it in an old koan. See the following. Main subject. Ryu Zenkaku asked Kinzan, what about when one arrow pierces the three barriers? Kinzan said, bring out the master of the three barriers and let me see him. Kinzan said, how long will you keep me waiting? Ryu said, a good arrow, but it has achieved nothing. And he was about to leave. Kinzan said, wait a bit, come here. Ryo turned his head. Kinzan took hold of him and said, leaving aside for a moment the arrow that breaks through the three barriers, just shoot an arrow at me. Ryo hesitated. Kinzan gave him seven blows and said, I should let you go on puzzling over this for 30 years. Secho's verse, I'd take the master of the barriers for you. Be mindful. You who let fly the arrow. If you stick to the ears are deafened. If you discard the eyes are blinded. How I like the arrow piercing the barriers. The arrow's path is clearly seen. Don't you recall, Genshot once said, the man of might is master of the mind prior to heaven. Probably very little of what I just read made any sense. Zen koans are more like poetry than anything else. Sometimes you hear a poem and its meaning is obvious to you. But sometimes you hear a poem and it's baffling for a while. And you carry it around in your mind, and then later, something about it begins to make sense. And you might have a moment where the deep meaning of the lines becomes obvious to you. You know, it might be long after you read it. I remember reading Robert Frost's poem, The Road Not Taken. And this is a poem that's required for school kids, maybe around the seventh grade. You read, maybe even earlier, you read Robert Frost's poetry, which people think of as very simple, straightforward poetry. And there's a very brief Robert Frost poem about a road not taken. And it's really a person remembering coming to a fork in a road and not taking one direction, but going in the other and always wondering what would have happened if he had gone in the other direction. You know, it seems so simple and straightforward. And at the time that I read it, I was just a kid. And I think that I was more interested in Star Trek than I was in poetry. And I probably read that poem and thought, okay, so what? The poem had no effect on me at all. And then many, many, many years later, 35 years later, I had a chance to meet somebody who was like an old high school sweetheart. And by this time I was married, and I met this person again, and I realized what a wonderful person she was, and how remarkably her life had unfolded. And I love my wife. I wasn't going to leave my wife, and this person wasn't inviting me to do it, you know. But when I met her, I thought to myself, I couldn't help it. I thought, my gosh, I could have married this person. How different my life would have been. And even though I was not regretting my life, the poem, Robert Frost's poem about the road not taken, it just popped into my mind. And of course, I felt a great... like something tugging at my heartstrings, because, you know, I had the feeling this would have been a wonderful road to take, and yet I knew that in this life I would never take it. And it was beautiful and a little heartbreaking to think that way, because I had chosen one road, and I went down that road, and now I knew where that was going, pretty much. And it had its... wonderful aspects and its limits, you know. And I thought to myself, what if we hadn't broken off? What if we had gotten married? What if we had had a life together? You know, what an interesting life it might have been. So the poem meant almost nothing at the time, but later, it meant a great deal. And even though I just read the words as a little kid, somehow they stayed in my mind, and they began to percolate over time. You know, 35 years after I first read that poem, I remembered it. And it helped me to understand my situation as an adult meeting an old high school flame. So koans are a little bit like that, you know. You'll hear me read a koan, and you might not think much about it, and you should definitely read them yourself, you know. And when you read them, they might not mean much at the moment when you read them, but later they might turn out to have a kind of psychological depth that you never suspected. So it's not so important that you remember the koan. The koan is really meant to be internalized. And so even if it doesn't make much sense, please don't worry. Somehow you'll be carrying this around with you. So in this koan, there's a... person named Ryo Zenkaku, and he asked Kinzan, who was a Zen teacher, what about when one arrow pierces the three barriers? This is from Buddhist Sutra, Buddhist scripture. He says, what about when one arrow pierces the three barriers? Kinzan said, basically, that's kind of an abstract question. You know, show me the person who fires the arrow. Let me see him. Ryo says, they have a conversation. And the idea is one person wants to understand this idea of an arrow that goes through the three barriers. And an answer is given, but it doesn't satisfy the teacher. And so we're left wondering, what is the arrow that pierces the three barriers? So if you want to remember what's important about this koan, just remember that image of an arrow piercing three barriers. I was recently reading a new translation of the Lankavatara Sutra, which is really, along with the Diamond Sutra, the major sutra in the Zen tradition. The Lankavatara Sutra has never really been successfully translated. D.T. Suzuki, the Japanese teacher, who was really an accomplished Rinzai master as well, tried to translate it maybe 50 years ago. And if you try to read it through, you'll find that it's almost like entering a madhouse. It's so confusing. And recently, the wonderful translator Red Pine, Bill Porter is his English name, has done a new translation of the Lankavatara Sutra, and it's really much better. Even though it's still like reading a madhouse. It's still like entering a madhouse. It's confusing. It's a strange book. After a while, you will, be thoroughly puzzled. But it actually is really, really important for the Zen tradition, because the Zen understands the mind in a way that's probably useful to hear about. You know, if you do Vipassana meditation, which is a really wonderful tradition of meditation, you learn how to bring your mind to the moment, just bringing it back to the moment. So Vipassana meditation involves sitting on a cushion, stilling the mind, entering samadhi, and then noting what is happening from moment to moment. And this is a really wonderful kind of meditation. This is mindfulness meditation. So you sit down on the cushion, you watch your breath. Vipassana people start by watching the breath. And you watch each breath going out and till you enter samadhi. And then you begin to note sensations. So you might hear my voice, and you note, you're aware of the sound of my voice. Then you hear the fan overhead, and you're aware of the sound of the fan. Then the next thing you notice is pain in your right leg, so you're aware of the pain. Then you hear the fan again. Then you notice your hands clenched together in your lap. Then you notice the pain in your leg, and so on. And that kind of meditation can be taken to extraordinary levels of refinement, so that you can eventually have extraordinary attentiveness to what's happening in every moment. We ordinarily are attentive or mindful to the moment only in very short intervals. And we miss a great deal. You know, we actually are aware of many different sensory inputs that we pay no attention to. And when you do Vipassana meditation, you begin to notice the extraordinary density of inputs, You'll notice many details of your sensory awareness that you're not normally aware of because you're thinking, or you're distracted, or you're having a memory or something. So Vipassana meditation is really quite a wonderful practice, and it's been shown to be terrifically effective with depression. You know, some people, when they're depressed, fall into obsessive thought patterns, rumination. And they can't get out of these obsessive thought patterns. They just keep looping back around, looping back around, looping back around. And the depression is usually produced by like an inability to get outside of these habitual patterns of thought. And one of the characteristics of somebody who's really depressed is that they feel there's no way out. And what they usually mean by that is that they can't break out of these habitual patterns. And Vipassana is really very healing for such people, because when you keep bringing your mind back to the moment and you bring your mind back to these sensory inputs, you begin to experience a loosening up of your consciousness. You begin to experience this wonderful, the loops begin to let you free. You stop ruminating, you stop thinking, and you're just following the flow of the moment from moment to moment to moment to moment. And this is a tremendously healing practice, and it is preserved in the Zen tradition as what is known as shikantaza. If you ever hear anybody say shikantaza, what they mean is they're doing mindfulness meditation. So in the Sao Tung, the Soto tradition of Zen originally, they just practiced mindfulness meditation. So even though people don't think of Zen as Vipassana, one school of Zen really does practice Vipassana. And shikantaza, or moment-by-moment awareness, is really this wonderful healing Vipassana practice. And I can't recommend it highly enough. It really is very liberating to just bring the mind back to the moment, to get out of these patterns of rumination and obsessive, often obsessive self-criticism. And if you ever do moment-by-moment awareness, it's quite stimulating, actually. You know, it's very healing just to bring your mind back to the moment. In the moment, when you're 100% in the moment, there is no emotional distress, really and truly. When you're 100% in the moment, there's no past and there's no future. There's just this moment, and the disappearance of past and future is incredibly liberating. And it produces this spacious awareness that's really quite wonderful. So, we do Vipassana also in our tradition when we're working with the breath. You follow the breath, and you notice maybe sounds as you're doing your breath perception. And the initial stage of meditation is a kind of Vipassana meditation for us too. But Zen is a little different. The Rinzai Zen, or Koan Zen, that we practice is a little different from a Vipassana, because we also are aware of another dimension of the mind, you could say, which is the unconscious mind. So when you're observing events from moment by moment, some of those events just seem to disappear from consciousness. But actually, some events never disappear from consciousness. When you're doing meditation practice, you may have had this experience, especially at Sesshin. where you're meditate. You know, when you begin to do meditation and you watch the breath, and you are just counting the breath and so on, you begin to have these moments of wonderful, wonderful simplicity and clarity, right? I'm sure you've had this. It's like sometimes beginners, when they come to sit, they sit down and they watch the breath and they just enter samadhi right away. And they feel great, you know. And they think, this is wonderful, you know. This is great. So they come back. And the next time they sit down, it's hard to get into samadhi because maybe some event of the day keeps cropping up as they're trying to watch the breath. You know. And this is a problem, right? You think you're going to sit down on the cushion, be 100% in the moment, and then something happened to you today that you can't let go of on the cushion. Now, that's an interesting problem, isn't it? Why can't you let go of it? You know? Why does it hold on to you? See, that's an interesting question. You know, if human beings could just go through life without that stickiness, you know, if things could just happen to us and we could just go on to the next moment, we would have, generally speaking, we would have wonderful lives, but we wouldn't be human beings, you know. So you know, I don't know if this is true, but I imagine, you know, that some animals just are in the moment all the time. It may not be true, you know, but I around my neighborhood I see deer. You know, and sometimes I will see deer and they're eating and I look over and they're chewing grass or something like that and they look so happy and placid. You know, I wonder, are they thinking about the past, you know? You know, are they sitting there thinking, this grass isn't as good as the grass last year, you know? Why is that, you know? Maybe I deserve to be eating bad grass. Maybe I did something, you know what I mean? I don't know if the deer are reflecting and ruminating on the grass, you know. I don't know if they're comparing this mouthful of grass with the mouthful of grass 2 years. And I don't know if they're sitting there thinking, how come he always gets the good grass and I get the lousy grass, you know? What is it with him, you know? Or you know, these are human forms of thought. You know, we... somehow we have experiences that are sticky and we can't let them go. And so, you know, you come in and you sit down on the cushion and maybe something happened to you during the day that might have seemed trivial at the time. Or maybe it was very painful. You know, maybe you met with a coworker and the coworker implied that you hadn't done your share on some project. And you felt that you had done your share, but now, you know, when the person said it, you began to doubt yourself, or you got mad because you felt you weren't being recognized or something like that. And then you sit down on the cushion, you come to sit in the evening, and you go home and you sit down on your cushion at home, and you find you can't let this go. You know, it just keeps coming back and coming back. See, this, I think, is quite interesting. If only humans could just go from moment to moment to moment without judgment, our lives would be so much better, right? I mean, it would be great. So, you know, basically, one day you're on your bicycle, and, you know, basically you're riding the bicycle, and... a car comes around the corner and it knocks you to the ground, and you go to the hospital, and after that, no problem. You heal up, you're on your bicycle again, no problem. But what's likely to happen is something like this. You know, the next time you get on your bicycle and you go around a corner, you feel dread, right? And you feel dread because the last time you did this, a car hit you. And you had to go to the hospital. So there's a dimension to the mind that we don't necessarily capture when we just talk about moment by moment awareness. You know, the mind has this other dimension. It's like under the surface, there's this other dimension. Some events have a stickiness for us. You know, we can't let them go. They leave an impression on us. They grip us on an unconscious level. And so, even though vipassana is very liberating, and even though vipassana is healing, it may not necessarily get to liberate us from some of our most important obstacles. Although I have met many people who are deeply enlightened who practice vipassana, there are other methods that may be more effective sometime, or effective for different people. And Zen, koan Zen, is very interested in the stickiness of things, right? So this problem of not being able to get free from events that leave a kind of an unconscious trail, or that have an unconscious stickiness, is a big problem for human beings, you know. Because when we sit down on the cushion, we want to be in the moment, but we find that things pop up. This especially happens at Sesshin. You know, you come to Sesshin, and you might find that on day two of Sesshin, something pops up that you hadn't thought about for years, you know. And it just won't let you go. It might seem trivial, it might be important. I don't know about you, but, you know, at Sesshin, I've remembered things that I thought I had forgotten for 30 years. If you haven't been alive for 30 years, you haven't had that experience. But even at Sesshin, even if you're much younger and you're at Sesshin, you might find you remember things on the cushion that you had forgotten for years and years. And it might surprise you that you still remember that. But actually, you know, from the Zen standpoint, from the standpoint of Zen psychology, almost everything that happens to us is actually in there somewhere, believe it or not. But certainly, there are some events which leave, which have a resonance or a stickiness, and that they shape our lives even though we're not aware that they're shaping our lives, you know? So Zen practice is all about, at least the kind of Zen we practice in our tradition here, is all about purifying the mind, freeing it from these unconscious factors which shape our experience of the world in ways we often don't even detect. So, you know, when I was young, I was not very athletic. You know, I was very clumsy and uncoordinated. My brother, for some reason, my brother was very athletic, and he was incredibly, he had this incredible coordination. So, you know, when my brother was 2 years younger than I was, and he was such a better runner, he could run so fast, and he was so coordinated, and people would throw a baseball to him, and he'd just stick up his hand and grab the ball, or football, you know. Somebody would say, "Peter, go out for a pass," and he'd run like the wind, and the guy would throw the ball, and Peter would just grab it, and it was amazing to me. Now, if somebody said to me, "Kurt, go out for a pass," I thought to myself, "Oh my God, you know, I'm going to drop it," right? And I would run, you know, and I wasn't a good runner like my brother. And somebody would throw the ball, and I would reach up, and I would fumble it. You know, it just would so many times I just didn't have good coordination. So, you know, this had an impact on me. You know, it affected many different things. You know, when I got to college, I had a chance to go out for some different sports, And I didn't do it, you know. Even in high school, I didn't do it because I thought, I didn't think about it. But instinctively, I shied away from events like that. And I didn't make a conscious decision. When somebody would say, do you want to do this? I wouldn't say, oh, no, no. I'm thinking about how I used to drop the football when I was 10 years old. But it's there. See, it's got a stickiness that shapes your life. Right? You might not even remember why. Why am I so hesitant? You know, when I was in college, I got interested in jogging. And so I bought a pair of sneakers and I started jogging. And even though I had not been a good runner like my brother, I really enjoyed running. And so it turns out that I loved running. I still run. You know, 40 years later, I'm still running. I overcame my fear, you could say, of like physical challenges. You know, I got into hiking, and I have spent many many happy days hiking in the mountains. You know, so I learned how to be a physical person, even though I was afraid to try certain things because of my karma. Yeah. So there's this other dimension to life, which is the stickiness of things, and we can't always see what kind of sticky things we're carrying around with us, and sometimes they manifest themselves in ways that we can't be aware of. But sometimes on the cushion we become aware of them. In Zen psychology, these events which have stickiness are called bija, seeds. It's like that moment when I'm trying to get the football and it just grazes my fingers and it falls to the ground. That's like that didn't go away. It's in my, it's stored away in my mind. And it's like a seed in my mind. This is Zen psychology. And that comes to the surface at some point, and it affects my behavior now. This sounds a little crazy, but you know, these events that have happened to us have stickiness, and they're unconscious, but they shape our lives in ways that are compulsive, and that are also can be obsessive. You know? So when you're doing your Zen practice, sometimes you can be surprised by what you're encountering on the cushion. You know, people come to Zen practice and they want, for example, to be happy, which is the goal of Zen practice. So you sit down on the cushion and you're watching your breath, and all of a sudden you might realize that you're very angry. You know? Some of Zen practice is really working through powerful emotion like that, and tracing it back to its source. Sometimes koans produce this kind of a recognition. So you could be working with a koan that might involve, not apparently have anything to do with anger. And you're sitting on the cushion and you're watching your breath, and then you're working with the koan, and all of a sudden you remember the fact that you could never talk to your father, you know, something like that. And you become very despondent, sad, and so on. And you might never have remembered a particular afternoon you spent with your father, or you tried to make contact with your father and he didn't respond to your overtures. You know, you might have forgotten all about that, but then as you're working with this koan, it comes to the surface and you encounter a whole range of emotions. Anger, maybe self-loathing, and so on. And this is not so uncommon in Zen practice. Sometimes you don't remember the event that produced the emotion. You know, sometimes you just feel anger. Where is this anger coming from? But in Zen, the way we deal with these obstacles, these unconscious seeds that come to the surface, is by bringing our mind back to the breath and back to emptiness, to mushin. So, if you are working on a koan and you suddenly become aware of sort of fear, you realize, my gosh, you know, I have fear almost all the time. You know, that's a quite possible, that could possibly happen during a session working on a koan. You could suddenly realize that you have fear. And you realize suddenly you see there's like an undercurrent of fear in a lot of your responses. And then, you know, you might, at some point, working with the koan, you might remember events, or you might not, you know, that produced this fear, or times when you were afraid, you know. But, you know, having remembered them, you're still not free. That fear is still there, you know. So how do you get free from those sort of compulsive, sticky events from the past that are under the surface of consciousness and shaping our lives? And the Zen technique is emptiness, mu. So, you know, you're sitting on the cushion, you suddenly realize that there's this undercurrent of anxiety in your life, and maybe you remember, you know, I can remember having to go to school in Baltimore, and every day I would wonder, am I going to get beaten up today? You know, this was... I still feel fear when I think about going to school in Baltimore, and it was such a tough neighborhood, and I was always in danger of getting beaten up, and sometimes I would get beaten up, you know, and I was just a little kid. It was so unfair, you know, and I didn't like to fight, you know. I went to my dad and I told him I was getting beaten up, and he said, "I'll show you." He showed me how to box, right? You know, that was not much help, right? It was so ridiculous, right? So he showed me how to hold my fists, you know, but I was terrified, you know. I wasn't going to stick my fist up, you know, I was terrified. You know, so, you know, I just wanted to run away, and I couldn't always run away. So it was a horror, you know, so you can see from my voice, I'm still frightened about this, you know. So you're sitting on the cushion and you suddenly remember having to go to school in Baltimore, and you realize, my God, I've been carrying around this anxiety all my life. You know, what am I going to do about this? And so then you go to your breath, and the breath takes you to this empty place, right? This empty place, which we call mu. And you go to the empty place, and then you remember Baltimore, and little by little, the power of that anxiety, the power of that fear, begins to diminish. And you may reach a point where you feel absolutely fearless. You feel, and you get off the cushion, you know, and you feel really wonderful. You can feel really purified. And that's a real moment of liberation. You know, if you... you know, if it's something that's really seriously challenging, you know, it might take many of such moments, right? You know, you might remember running for your life in Baltimore and being afraid, and then you work with mu, you work with emptiness, and you begin to feel better. Then you go to bed and you get up the next day, and there's the fear again. You know, so you set to work again. It's like dissolving this karmic obstacle. In Zen, we have a metaphor for this process. You know, if you go to Zen gardens, sometimes you see stones that have been worn away by water. And the idea that a little drop of water can wear away a stone or a mountain is very important in Zen, because it represents what we're doing when we're working with our obstacles, you know. Each breath, each moment of mu might seem really inconsequential when you're trying to work through a tremendously difficult a mountain of karma, right? A mountain of karma, which seems to be as firm and indestructible as stone, right? But you just take it one breath at a time, one move, one moment of emptiness at a time, and little by little, you find your life has changed, you know? So you become aware, maybe, when you're working with a koan, that you have an undercurrent of fear. You know, maybe you don't. Some people do. And you realize all the moments in your life, maybe there were particular moments in your life where you were terrified. You know, I was terrified. And then you work with Mu, and you work with the breath, and the fear goes away, and you go to bed, and you get up, and there's the fear. And then you work with the breath, and you work with Mu, and the fear goes away. And you think, I'm never going to get free of this fear. But actually, you know, there comes a day when you're actually free of the fear. You know, all humans have a kind of normal, instinctive fear. But this compulsive anxiety or compulsive fear is another matter. And the day will come when you have you feel differently, you know. Maybe a session ends and you walk outside and you suddenly realize, I feel different. I feel so relaxed. You know, what's missing? Maybe you realize, oh my God, it's my fear. You know, so this is really quite an important element of Zen practice. That moment-by-moment awareness is very healing, but some of our obstacles are not accessible through that method. And we really need to encounter these obstacles in the unconscious mind in order to be in the moment without this karmic baggage. You know, this karmic baggage. You know, the Zen ideal is somebody who is pretty free from those compulsive behaviors, pretty free from those obsessive fears or anxieties, you know. If you ever see the Zen ox herding pictures, you know, there's a wonderful series of pictures. If you Google it, if you haven't seen it, you should do Zen ox herding pictures. And it's all about Zen practice, but the last scene is a scene of a bodhisattva, Pu Hua. He's a big fat guy, and he's totally free from his karmic obstructions, or he's mostly free. And he's walking into town with a big bag of goodies to give to people because he just wants to help other people. And his belly is hanging out, and he doesn't care about how he looks. He's just like that deer eating the grass, right? He just goes from moment to moment without carrying this baggage with him. And his face is so happy. He's so joyous because at last he's not carrying this heavy weight of karma with him. So you know, Zen practice has a dimension of vipassana, moment-by-moment awareness. And it's vipassana is wonderful for people who are struggling with depression. But Zen has a long-term therapeutic program for you, and it involves encountering our submerged or unconscious obstacles and working through them using mindfulness and Mu. And so you could think of a koan training, even though you might not have noticed this. You know, you could think of koan training as being all about working through our unconscious fears and obstacles. And nobody is totally free. No ordinary human being ever gets totally free from all this baggage. But people can get very, very, very free. Right? And in the meantime, they can also recognize their baggage so that it doesn't bother them so much. Now, there's one, you know, so when you are calling Mu and you're using Mu to dissolve your obstacles, you know, I mentioned earlier, I said that if you're 100% in the moment, there is no distress. There's no distress, no psychological distress if you're 100% in the moment, and that's true. It is also the case, it's also my belief anyway, that there's no karmic obstacle that Mu can't dissolve. It may take a long time, but if you keep working with Mu Xin, if you keep working with that emptiness, you will dissolve any obstacle. And by the way, you see this at Sesshin. You know, sometimes I have been at Sesshin and I have seen people, you know, once in a while you'll see people who have very hard time around day two of Sesshin sitting still. And it's really not necessarily their legs. It's not their bodies. It's this unconscious level. They're struggling with a lot of things under the surface that are making them restless, making them nervous, making them, yeah. And basically, you know, sometimes it's like they're going to jump right out of their skin, right, you know. But, people come to Sesshin and with great determination and courage, they keep coming back to emptiness, back to emptiness, back to emptiness. You know, by day four or five of a Sesshin, I see people who on day two are ready to jump out of their skin, and by day four, day five, they have this wonderful, placid face. And you look and they're so quiet. Their body is so still on the cushion. You know, so it can be done. You know, sometimes in Zen practice, we encounter things we have tried very hard to hide. This happens, you know. Sometimes we encounter things we have wanted, you know, some things are pretty bad. They happen to us, they're pretty bad, and unconsciously we have buried them very, very far under the surface, you know. We don't ever want to see this stuff again, you know, so we bury it. We think it's out of sight, out of mind, but you know, Zen psychology says nothing is ever out of mind. Nothing. It's all in there. It's all in there. So, you know, I might say, well, Baltimore, I haven't been to Baltimore in 50 years, and I'll never go back, you know. But, you know, Baltimore is still right here with me, you know. It's still here. You know, and I could bury it, you know, I could bury it, but it's going to come back. This is Zen psychology. There's a very strong element of awareness of the repressed, you know, the return of the repressed. It's there. And sooner or later, and the problem with burying it is it's going to dictate your behavior, right, you know. It's like you go to work and your boss gives you a hard time and you come home and the dog is barking at you and you say, shut up, right? You're not mad at your poor dog. You love your dog. You're mad at your boss, right? So this happens to us in big ways too. You know, things happen to us that are hugely consequential. You know, maybe you're an easy person, you have a quick temper. You're easy to anger. You think, why am I so easy to anger? Who knows? You can't say, I have to stop being so angry. That doesn't work. Right? That doesn't work. You know, count to 10. That doesn't work. You get mad while you're counting to 10. You get mad about counting to 10. So you know, if you want to come to terms with the sources of your anger, you have to do a lot of work. Some kind. And in Zen that would mean a lot of sitting. You can do therapy, you could do therapy in Zen, it works very well. But to get free from these sticky events, we have to be able to go down into that that storehouse mind. It's called in Zen the storehouse mind. We call it the unconscious. In Zen it's called the storehouse. You know, and a lot of Zen practice is just pulling junk out of the storehouse, you know. You pull this out, oh my gosh, is this still around? You know, pull this out. But after a while, your bag is less filled with junk, and you can move more easily through the world and be happier. And that's nice. One more thing, though, that's very important. You know, the unconscious mind in Zen is not neutral. The essence of the human mind is compassion. The essence of the human mind. If you go through all the layers of your mind, the top layer is the part of your mind that says, "I have to get some dog food on my way home." Right? There's a layer of your mind which is made up of just like fragments of thoughts. You know. If you go deeper, there's a layer of mind which is memory. If you go deeper, there's a layer of mind which is like your image factory. Right? It's making images. You know. And you keep going down through the layers of the mind, and you get to the unconscious. You get to the storehouse. Right. But at the core of the mind, at the core of the mind, is just this luminous compassion. That's the essence of your mind, this luminous, bright compassion. Sometimes people encounter it the second time they sit down. They say, "What happened on the cushion?" They'll say, "My mind became so bright, and I felt so happy, you know." Oh. But you know, sometimes it takes years and years. But at the center of the human being, at the core of your mind, it's like a radiant, it's a sun, it's like the sun. It's the sun of compassion, S-U-N. Like the ball of light and radiating compassion. But it's covered up with all this junk, you know. And we're working our way down to this. But we're working our way down to it, but also it's working its way up to us. You know, believe it or not, that's the most remarkable thing. So even though sometimes the unconscious mind holds unpleasant surprises for us, it's very important to remember that it's trying to help us wake up. And it's trying to protect us. Your unconscious mind is constantly trying to protect you. And shelter you from suffering. It's constantly guarding you. Even when you're asleep, your unconscious mind is looking out for you. You know? And in Zen practice, your unconscious mind is working just as hard as you are to wake up. Isn't that interesting? When people have Daikensho, they realize this right away. Oh my God! It was there all along. It's been helping me all this time. Really. And that's really one arrow penetrating all the barriers at once. Kinzan. Ryo Zenkaku asked Kinzan, "What about when one arrow pierces the three barriers?" It could be a million barriers. Kinzan said, "Bring out the master of the barriers and let me see him. Let me get to to that root consciousness, which is pure, radiant compassion. Bring out the barrier and let me see him." Ryo said, "If that's the case, recognizing my fault, I will withdraw." Kinzan said, "How long will you keep me waiting?" Ryo said, "A good arrow, but it has achieved nothing." So they're just going back and forth. And Kinzan finally says, "You don't get it yet. You haven't worked through your barriers yet. But just keep trying. Every time a barrier goes away, you feel a little better." Secho's verse, "I'd take out the master of the barriers for you. Be mindful, you who let the arrow fly. If you stick to the ears are deafened. If you discard the eyes are blinded. How I like the arrow piercing the barriers. The arrow's path is clearly seen. Don't you recall, Gensha once said, the man of might is master of the mind prior to heaven." Well, the man of might is that radiant, radiant, compassionate intelligence at the heart of your mind, which is working so hard to liberate you. So, please practice Zen with great diligence. I can't tell you how many times I've sat down on the cushion, anxiety, fear, etc. Get up and I feel like life is renewed, like green shoots coming out of a branch that was withered and barren. So I'm sure you've had the same experience or you wouldn't be here today. So let's just keep practicing this beautiful path together.